Today, to hear our first shiur from Rabbi Kenneth Brander. Rabbi Brander is the Dean of Yeshiva University's Center for the Jewish Future, which was launched in 2004. CJF is the nexus of Yeshiva University's efforts to shape and effectively impact Jewish life and the Jewish future. Rabbi Brander is Rabbi Emeritus of the Boca Raton Synagogue, Dean of the Boca Raton Community Kollel, and founder of the Weinbaum Yeshiva High School of Broward and Palm Beach Counties. During his 14 years of service to that community, he spearheaded numerous initiatives to build the Boca community. He's an alumnus of Yeshiva College and received his ordination from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. There he had the distinction of serving as the personal aide to the esteemed Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He received special ordination from Machon Pua, a center of medical ethics in Israel, in 1999, and from the Chief Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu in the field of medical ethics, infertility, gynecology, and halacha. He is currently a PhD candidate in general philosophy at Florida Atlantic University. It is now my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Brander.
I want to first thank Avi for introducing me. Avi, just raising up for a second. Avi is a presidential fellow at Yeshiva University. I have the privilege of him being a presidential fellow under the Center for the Jewish Future. And tomorrow, Amir Tashem, he goes to Eretz Israel because there are going to be over the winter break a little bit more than 350 students in Israel, and there is a series of leadership programs that we're running, and Avi is the quarterback for those programs. 25 students will be going to the Golan Galil area to do some serious work there, and then 300 of them will be located in the Yerushalayim area, and there is a series of different leadership opportunities for them. So we thank him. We thank Avi for all that he does, and we appreciate all of his work. The topic today, the first shiur, is the issue of the role of divine intervention in the halachic process. Does nevuah, does HaKadosh Baruch Hu play a role within the halachic process post Matan Torah? We're told. Are you doing okay here? I just wanted to be sure. We're told. Thank you. We're told. Thank you. We're told. I've been doing this for 15 years without a microphone. I can continue. We're told that that lo bashamayim hi, the Torah was no longer in heaven. V'lo me'ever layam hi, ki karov elecha davar ma'od v'ficha v'vavcha la'soso. That there is this notion that the Torah is no longer in heaven. What exactly does that mean from a purely halachic perspective? And how do we understand that? Based on scanning and studying various different Gemaras, various different Rishonim and Achronim, how do they embrace the notion of Lo Bashamayim Hi? So hopefully together, over the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be able to discuss that issue. So let's open up our sources. We begin with the famous Gemara that I'm sure you're all familiar with. The famous Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis. The Gemara of Machlokas between Rabbi Elezer and Chachamin regarding the Tanur of Achnai. This was an interesting Tanur, an interesting oven. We know in order for a Kli, in order for something to be Mekabel Tumah, it has to be a Kli. It has to be able to hold liquid. So the question is, what about this Tanur of Achnai, this Tanur in which it was shaped like an oven, it functioned as an oven, but the sides were not connected. They were rather strapped together with a band, and that's what held it together. Is that considered a keli? Is that considered a vessel? Because essentially, if you cut the band, all the sides would just fall away. So you have a machlokas for Rabbi and Chachamim, whether it is a keli or not. The nafkamina being that if it is a keli, then it can be makabel toma. If it's not a keli, then it cannot be makabel toma. So the Chachamim disagreed with Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Elazar tries to prove that he's right. And there's a series of things that Rabbi Elazar does to prove that he's right. He says, "Im halacha kamosi, if the halacha is like me, then the carob tree outside the Beit Midrash should uproot itself. And the Gemara says that the carob tree uproots itself, whether 100 amos, whether 400 amos, the carob tree uproots itself. And the rabbis respond, we don't bring proofs from the actions of a carob tree. The Gemara continues, says, if I'm right, then the water that flows right outside the Beit Midrash should begin to flow backwards, and sure enough, in order to prove that Rabbi Eleza is right and not the Chachamim, it begins to flow backwards. He says, if I'm right, the walls of the Beit Midrash should begin to fall in. And all of a sudden, the walls of the Beit Midrash begin to fall in. And what happens is that Rabbi Yeshua gets up, he turns to the walls, and he says, what right do you have to negotiate or be involved, interrupt a dialogue between the rabbis on a halachic issue? And the Gemara says that the walls stop falling in out of respect to Rabbi Yeshua, but don't return to the original position out of respect to Rabbi Eleazar and his approach. We go on further, and Rabbi Eleazar says, if the law is like me, then there should be a bas kol that comes from Shemayim, a heavenly voice. And what happens is that a heavenly voice comes out and says the halacha is like Rabbi Eleazar. Nevertheless, despite all of these forms of divine intervention, we do not paskin like Rabbi Eleazar, we paskin like the Chachamim. And in fact, the story continues, on many different levels, but the story continues that Rabbi Nasan met Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, and said, what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing at this time? And it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kachayich, he was smiling, Nitzchuni banai Nitzchuni, my children have won, my children have won. Despite the fact that I advocated one position, namely that this tanur is not a chepza, is not an object, is not a keli, the Chachamim felt differently, and the Chachamim won, and I, God, lost. This is the paradigm piece of Gemara that celebrates the idea that's found in the Torah of Lo Bashamayim. The question is it so simple as that? Is it just always like that we paskin lo bashamayim hi, or is there some nuances that need to be introduced? So let's look through some of the Gemaras and we'll discuss it. Source number two, we're not going to have time to go through all of these sources. These sources you can go through on your own. We'll highlight some of them. We'll dig deep into those that require a little bit more discussion, but there's a beautiful series of sources here that hopefully you'll find the time to study on your own or b'chavruta. The Gemara in Temura and Daf Tezayin Amud Aleph is a Gemara that discusses the idea that Yoshua, when he is, before he becomes in charge of the Jewish people, Moshe turns to him and says, is there any laws you have any questions on? He says, what do you mean? I've been in your Beit Midrash all the time. I have no more questions. Moshe dies. He forgets 3,000 halachot. His congregants want to kill him. You know, what do you mean you have to still learn? I thought you had smicha, you know? And what happens is that they say to him, why don't you just ask God? And what happens is that Yoshua says, even though these are laws that have already been learned, it's forbidden for us to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lo bashamayim hi. He has to relearn the sources, reinterpret the sources, to extrapolate from those the laws, the 3,000 laws. That again is keeping with the idea we just said. And the idea is further actualized in source number 3. This source comes from the Arvei Pesachim, where there's a machlokas between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, and the Braita says the halacha is like Beit Hillel. So source number 3, let's look inside. The halacha ke Beit Hillel. The law is like Beit Hillel. So the Gemara asks, Pshita, the Hanafik Baskol, why do we need a Braita for? There's a Baskol that said we pass them like Beit Hillel, so you shouldn't need a Braita. Iba Yisema, answer number 1 is, the Braita was written before the Baskol, and that's why you needed the Braita. The Iba Yisema, or another answer is, La'achar Baskol, the Braita was written after the Baskol, but you still need a Braita to tell us we pass them like Beis Hillel. It's interesting to note that when you have a V'Iba Yisema, when you have two answers, the final answer of the Gemara is the prevalent answer, is the stronger answer. That is found in the Tshuvas of the Marshal, Simon Laman Hay, where the Marshal says in his discussion of certain literary styles of the Gemara that when there is a one answer and then a V'i Bayesema, it's trying to tell you that the V'i Bayesema is the real answer. So So what's the real answer here? The real answer is the Paschal was already given. But you still need a Breita to actualize and accentuate the point that we postulate Beis Hillel. And if one wants to do some serious research on it, the Encyclopedia Talmudit in Volume 9, Chapter 31, page 330, Divrei HaMaskil, Halacha, also explains all of the different personalities, achronim, that list this notion of anytime it says ve'i bayasema, that is the more prevalent answer. The same idea is highlighted in Source 4 and 5. Source 4 and 5 you have where David HaMelech is told that the Pelishtim are robbing certain areas of the Jewish people, and it says that David asks the Urim V'Tumim if he should engage in war. So the Gemara says, how do you ask the Urim V'Tumim? It's a halacha in Melchama. That's a law, that's a halacha. You should not be able to ask any form of divine substance. You can't ask the Urim V'Tumim. So Gemara says, you're right. They asked the Beis Din of Shmuel. The Beis Din of Shmuel said they have to go to war. So that was the halachic responsibility, to go to war. They were just asking the Urim V'Tumim whether they would win or not. Sometimes you have to go to war and you lose, unfortunately. So they wanted to know if they were going to win. But you see the Gemara immediately tries to subjugate the dialogue of the Urim V'Tumim in a way in which it's not dealing with a halachic issue. And Rashi concretizes that in source number 5. The Maris Chayas and Sukkah discusses this, the Aruch HaNir and Sukkah discusses this on the notion of the Minhag of Arava, where it seems that it was divinely re-engaged, and the Maris Chayas and the Aruch HaNir and Sukkah, Daf Mem Daud Omen Aleph, also discusses the same idea. And this is what the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei Torah tells us. If you look at the third line in Halacha Aleph, it tells us, Shekol Divrei Torah Mitzuvim Anu La'asosam Ad Hayom, and you cannot allow a prophet to teach you any new halachas, Lo Vashemayim Hi. It's no longer in heaven. Nevertheless, if we turn to the second page, we begin to see some slight cracks in this very rigid approach. And the first one is found in the Gemara itself. I translated this Gemara, or I cut and paste the translation to be more exact, where it says clearly that we're told in the Chumash that Le'ela Techaleka Aretz, that you should split the land of Eretz Yisrael. It says, Al Piagaro Techaleka Aretz, that you should split the land through a lottery. And the Gemara in Baba Basra, Daf Kuf of Kuch of Bet Amid Aleph, explains how the whole lottery system worked. It was a divinely inspired lottery. It was a lottery used with the Urim V'Tumim. So here it clearly seems that there is a role for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to play within the halachic process. Clearly, Yerusha is a halachic issue. And we see that there is a lottery being used. So Rav Kook reminds us in source number 8 that yes, there are times in which we use divine intervention, but that needs to be established within the Torah. The Torah tells you the exception to the rule. The Torah tells you, Le'ela techaleka aretz, al pi agaro techalek. And by the way, Rav Kook says anything to do with the Beis HaMikdash, based on other psukim, you can use divine intervention. But basically, there's a buy on this institution of divine intervention. And the buy is when the Torah indicates that this is a unique situation, that we allow some type of divine intervention to make our halachic decisions. But normally, divine intervention doesn't work. So you see source number 8, where Rav Kook says that. Indeed, this idea is actually highlighted in the following source number 9. Let's say a guy has the following thing. He knows his father left him a pot of money, a pot of gold. He doesn't know where the pot of gold is. His father appears to him in a dream and says, I want you to know the pot of gold I left for you is in the attic. It's behind this plank in the corner. If you lift up the plank and then you move the other plank, you'll see the pot of gold. Immediately in the morning, he gets up. And the father, by the way, in the dream tells him one other thing. You know that pot of gold that you're going to find up there? It's really supposed to be given to Yeshiva University, totally all of it, half to Yeshiva University, and half to, since Dean Burns is here, and half of it is designated to the College of Medicine. And so what happens is, not only does the father say that where the where the money is. He says half is to REITs, half is to the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. In the same dream, sure enough, he wakes up the next morning exactly where his father in the dream showed him is the pot of gold. Does this person, now that he has his pot of gold, is it considered mammon of hekdesh? Is it considered mammon of tzedakah? Does he have to give half of it? Does he have to call Rabbi Bieler up and give half of it to REITs and half of it to Dean Burns, to Einstein? So the answer is that no, he does not have to give any of it to anyone, because it's not that the dream isn't true. The dream is 100% true. But the dream cannot create a chepsa shel kedusha, or a chepsa at all. It cannot create some type of defined halakhic process. Dreams cannot play a role within the halakhic process. So the Gemara tells us, source number 9, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And by the way, for every Gemara I'm bringing, there's like 10 more Gemaras, but these are just selections that celebrate the ideas that we're discussing. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us, Hareshaya Mitzara Mo Shenich Lo Aviv. He knows his father left him a pot of gold. Uba Bala Chalon Vamarlo, Kach Vakach Hemba Makamploni. Here it is. It's, you know, 100 gold coins in this place. And you should know they're Meiser Sheni. What are you supposed to do with it? The answer is that, as the Shulchan Aruch says in Source 10, that even though the money's in the exact location, it's the exact amount of coins, it's not of tztaka, eino klum, de divrei chalomot, lo ma'alim v'lo lo maridim. It plays no halachic role whatsoever. Nevertheless, we see in Source 11 a case in which a chalom does play a role. And perhaps you can help me process why this is different. The Gemara says the following. Let's say Rabbi Yosef was put in the cherem. And in a dream. And what is supposed to happen? Rabbi Yosef says, let's say someone's put in the cherem in a dream. How do you deal with that cherem? So the Gemara says you need 10 people to be matir that cherem. The Gemara says they should be learned people. If they're not learned people in halacha, minimally they should be people who study Mishnayos. If they don't do that, minimally they should be able to read. If they can't read, they can be any 10 people. But the bottom line is, 10 people should be matir the cherem that he had in a dream. And this is not just the Gemara. We passing like this in the Shulchan Aruch. Source number 12, the next page of the handout, tells us this halacha. The source number 12 tells us, niduhu b'chalon, if he is excommunicated in a dream, have a nidui v'tzarech hatara, it needs hatara, and it goes through, 10 people, they should be learned. If they're not learned, even if they can't read, those 10 people can be used. So Nu, help me process this. Why is it that when it comes to a pot of gold that can be given to REITs, we paskin divrei chalomos lo umalim lo maridin, but when it comes to a cherem that a cherem in a dream, so you still have to deal with that cherem? Anyone? Yeah, but it's still a halach. It's creating a halachic identity on something, on the individual that he might be in cherem. Why does it have the strength to do that? Yes.
In the first one, the dream would have created the halachic obligation.
Okay.
In the second one, we say if you have this dream, the halacha tells you, the resident tells you what to do with that.
Yeah,
but like the dream itself creates.
No, the dream is creating it, or else you wouldn't have asked the basin to do anything. Yes. Beautiful answer. It's the answer that the son of the Nodeb Yehuda, Rav Shmuel Landau, the Shiva Sion, gives in trying to understand this in Source 13. He says that cherem is a stigma placed on an individual deserving of punishment for a grave wrongdoing. If dreams are a form of divine communication, says the Shiva Sion, then such a dream may be a divine sign that punishment is destined for the dreamer. As in any case of dreams in which an ominous event may be a foreshadowing of an ominous event, We're concerned about the mental well-being, of the individual. And therefore, an outlet has to be provided for the dreamer to rid him or herself of any anxiety that may accompany such a dream. For example, the institution of Tanit Chalom, which allows you to fast on Shabbos or even on some Chagim. So the nullification of the Schayrim issued in a dream is not treated with the same rigor that's standardly employed with a regular Chayrim situation. If we treated this as a regular Chayrim, you couldn't dummy down, so to say, the personalities that could release you from the Chayrim. Rather, the nullification of this Chayrim issued in the dream is considered a necessary outlet to help the dreamer deal with his or her concerns of a pending doom. And Rev Landau gives you another example. He even gives you an example that if there's water that is found outside your home, and this water is uncovered, that the Notabi Huda writes, that the Gemara writes, that perhaps you're not allowed to drink that water. Because why? Because maybe a poisonous snake inserted some poison within this water. So the Notabi Huda, the Shiva Sion, Rav Shmuel Landau, the son of the Notabi Huda, explains, as was just explained here, and that is that it's a different reason altogether. It's not because it's creating a chetz of, it's not because it's creating a halachic institution, it's a psychological necessity. I remember when I was when I started in the rabbinate in Boca Raton, I was asked by the Federation to make the Federation kosher. And the Reform and Conservative rabbis came to me and said, would you make the Federation kosher? The Federation was glatt treif. What I mean by that is, it was over lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo l'chol ashitas, because they were serving milk and meat together, and the meat was the meat that answers to a higher authority. So the bottom line is, it was perhaps kosher meat, and it was milk. It was mamish basav chalav. So I called Rabbi Schechter, and I asked who I always ask my shaylos to. I called Rabbi Schechter. I asked him, the conservative from rabbis have asked me to do this. We'll create a kashrus committee, not a vada kashrus. The vada kashrus will just be me, but the kashrus committee will be lay leaders, and they'll be from the whole Jewish community. Should I do this? So Rav Shechter said, the shaila is not whether you should do it. The shaila is whether it's permitted for you not to do it. In other words, do you have a right to say no to this? You must do this. So what happens? The person that gave meat, that gave hashgacha to the meat that answers to the higher authority, lived in Miami Beach. So here's this 29-year-old schnook who's about to give hashgacha, and the first thing he does is he ossers that meat for a campus that's 30 acres large, that has a nursing home and a few other things. It's a big offer. It's a major thing. Dr. Solomon is here. He can attest to this. So what happens is that all of a sudden I start seeing in the Allgemeiner Journal on the front page that we warn the rabbi of Boca Raton not to work with Reform and Conservative rabbis, and all of a sudden I get a phone call that I'm being put in Chayrim by the Satmar Beis Din. All of a sudden. So all of a sudden people start hearing about this Chayrim. So Rabbi Lipstein calls me up and says, you've been in Boca 6 months and you've already been put in Chayrim? You're doing a great job. That's unbelievable. Rabbi Riskin calls me up and says, I can teach you how to make money off of being put in Chayrim. But my wife was not into me being put in Chayrim. And Rabbi Schechter was paying miserably for this. Rabbi Schechter was not permitted to dance at certain weddings in the middle of the circle, because what had happened was the person was so involved with a piece of the Jewish community that perceives itself to be more to the right, that basically not only attacked me, but they wanted to put pressure on the person who could stop me. And the only person who could stop me was Rabbi Schechter. So when he went to weddings, they wouldn't let him dance in the center of the circle during this whole thing. So Rabbi Schoenfeld, who was my rabbi, got involved with this, and so did the Yibadol Ben Chaim L'Chaim, Steve Dworkin. And the bottom line is, people realized that it was that the person was doing this because he didn't want Hebrew National to lose a very big account, and not for any other reason. So the Satmar Beis Din actually called me and apologized for thinking about putting me in Chayrim. They called me and asked Mechila. And I made a commitment to myself at that point in time, and my wife went into premature labor over this because we started getting all of these image, these horrible phone calls. And I made it a commitment that because Rabbi Schachter had stood with me with this, and now there's a 100-acre campus that's totally glatt kosher simply because of Rabbi Schachter's strength and because Rabbi Schachter, and also a whole bunch of, that's how the ORB was born through this initiative, that every time we built an institution in Florida, I always invited Rabbi Schachter to be the guest speaker. As Hakaras HaTov, that when I was almost put in Cherem, and not in a dream, that I would thank my Rebbe for making sure that, for seeing what he had accomplished by sticking with one of his Talmidim. We go to source number 14, and we move to a very famous case, the Barbutus story, the Barbutus fish. The Barbutus fish is a fish that the Balei HaTosfos said that they checked, and this Barbutus fish is a kosher fish. You don't see its fins and scales. So the Balei HaTosfos said two things. Number one is you look at the eggs that this fish secretes, and these eggs are halachically kosher eggs. Apparently there are certain styles of eggs of a fish that are only produced by kosher fish. And furthermore, they said that the fins or scales come out or disappear when they're taken out of the water, but they're always there from the beginning. The Or Zeruah on source number 15 has the following story from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, where Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid says that anyone who eats the Barbutus fish will not be zocha in the future to eat the Leviathan, will not be zocha to the Olam Haba, because there's a story of Rabbi Ephraim Bar Yitzchak, who one time permitted the Barbutus fish, and that night his father-in-law brought him, and it doesn't say his father-in-law in this, in the Or Zeruah, but in the other manuscript of this, in the Ravan, it does say his father-in-law. His father-in-law bought him, during a dream, a bowl of rodents, and wanted him to eat these non-kosher rodents. So Rabbi Ephraim got up that night and said, why would my father-in-law do that? One could think of many reasons, but why would the father-in-law do that? But the bottom line is, his conclusion was that his father-in-law did it because he was martyred something during that day that he shouldn't have been martyred. And his thing was, I martyred the Barbutus fish, which the Balei HaTosfos had said were permitted. So therefore he said, from this dream I learned that the Balei HaTosfos are wrong, and you cannot eat the Barbutus fish, and whoever eats the Barbutus fish will not eat from the fish of Leviathan. So along comes the Noda B'Yehuda later on, and many other people, and they say, what kind of a crazy thing is this? Who gives this guy the right to make a decision that he was greater than the Balei HaTosfos? Why didn't the Balei HaTosfos get dreams from their father-in-laws about serving them rodents? Why? What type of thing? Maybe he martyred something else that had nothing to do with this. He gave hashgacha to something else he shouldn't have given hashgacha to. The bottom line is, divrei chalamot, lo ma'alim, v'lo maridim, and therefore there's no proof whatsoever, at all, that one can suggest that you can use a dream. It's foolishness to use this Rebbe Ephraim. It's you know, he speaks in very negative terms and says that you can't follow this whatsoever. Yet we see that there are styles amongst the Rishonim which seem to indicate the use of divine intervention. For example, source number 17. You have the Ravid, where the Ravid speaks about the halachic issues of the Hadas, where the Hadas's tip was cut off. And the Ravid says, Kfar Hofia Ruach HaKodesh B'Beit Midrashenu, that I learned from Ruach HaKodesh in my base medrash what the halacha is. So here you see the Ravid's paskening from Ruach HaKodesh. So Dr. Twersky writes in his beautiful book on the Ravid that he says that sometimes there are idioms used that don't mean what you think they mean. And many times when the Ravid and others who lived around that time used statements that seem to be, that they sound like they're Ruach HaKodesh, it has nothing to do with Ruach HaKodesh. Dr. Twersky in Source 18 says, judging by historical precedent, therefore there is no reason to expect the Ravid's usage to harbor special esoteric beliefs or mystical notions. These phrases rooted in traditional scriptural idiom were quite conventional. It should also be observed that the term sowed by itself was a standard designation for any original thinking. And the next paragraph he says the same thing. On one occasion, the Ravid refers explicitly to the appearances of the Holy Spirit in the house of study. This would seem at first sight as a conscious, meaningful variation of the standard reference to heaven, and consequently most troublesome for a non-literal interpretation. Yet my contention, says Dr. Tversky, is about the metaphorical value of this entire family of phrases applies in great measure to this as well. In other words, it's a stylistic statement. It's not to be taken literally. And if you want to look at those pages in Dr. Tversky's thing, he gives you a myriad of sources that prove his point. Perhaps the point is most defined in a very beautiful comment that you see with Rav Yosef Karo. What do we know about Rav Yosef Karo? Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, lived, born in 1488, immigrated to Eretz Yisrael in 1536, became the chief rabbi of Tzfat, lived a schizophrenic existence. On one hand, he was a great halachist. On the other hand, he was also a great Kabbalist. I didn't mean to say schizophrenic totally in any classical terms, but he lived in two worlds. And the Shalah writes how he would see Rav Yosef Karo, he gives an example in Shavuos, being visited by a Magid, being visited by some type of divine spirit that would engage in dialogue with Rav Yosef Karo, to the point that Rav Yosef Karo wrote a diary of those discussions, which are called the Magid Misharim, right? The dialogue of those discussions. Here's the interesting thing. What you see is that many times the Magid tells him what he thinks the halacha is, what is a halacha from heaven, but the Shulchan Aruch that Rav Yosef Karo wrote does not follow what the Magid said. Let me give you two examples of that. One example is how many times you say Amen in Kaddish. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch, source 19, the Shulchan Aruch says that you say Amen three times. If you look at source 21, you'll excuse me, it's what happens when someone younger than us takes the sources and reduces them. They become a little bit more challenging to read. I think there's a bunch of college students here. But if you look at the second, on source 21, the second paragraph of source 21, from Parshas Todos Yitzchak, the Magid says you shouldn't say Amen just three times, you should say Amen five times. But even though the Magid says that that's what the halacha is, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Karo, even though he writes it in his diary that this is what the Magid tells him, he does not codify halacha like that. Because from the discussions of the Gemara, it doesn't seem to be the halacha. So even though it's clear that the Magid tells him that this is what God wants, Amen five times, but the bottom line is, that's not what he writes as a halacha. Another example is, he had a dream that his son was ill and that his son would die. And he had this dream on Rosh Hashanah. And the Shulchan Aruch, the Magid told him, you should fast. So the Rav Yosef Karo responds, if I fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, I have to fast for the rest of my life on both days of Rosh Hashanah, forever. If I fast just on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, for the rest of my life, I only have to fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So I'm going to wait to the second day of Rosh Hashanah to fast. The Magid says, you're wrong. If you fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, for the rest of your life, you only have to fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. You don't have to fast on the first and second day of Rosh Hashanah. It's the whole Yom Arifta thing of Rosh Hashanah. So here you have the Magid telling Rav Yosef Karo, you have this dream that your son is going to die, fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and for the rest of your life you have to fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, but not on the second day. And you have the Shulchan Aruch, you have Rav Yosef Karo being told this by the Magid, and nevertheless he refuses to do it, and when he writes the halacha of fasting on Rosh Hashanah, he writes against what the Magid told him, because that, even though it is divinely inspired, it's not what the halacha learned from the text. If you read the Gemaras, it's a Yom Arichta. If you fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, you have to fast for the rest of your life on both the first and second day. So even though in source 20, we're told that if you fast on the first day, you have to fast on the first day for all of your life, Tzarech Lasano Shnei Yamim Kol Yamav, the Magid in source 21, the first paragraph, told them if you fast on the first day, you only have to fast on the first day of the rest of your life. This is an unbelievable thing, where you actually see, and this is why I meant schizophrenic, you actually see Rav Yosef Karo, he has two bodies of literature, one is mystical, one's halachic. He does not allow the mystical literature to influence his halachic conclusions. Perhaps even unbelievable from that is another piece, and that is the introduction in source 22 of the Sifra Ditzinuta. The Sifra Ditzinuta is a piece by Rav Chaim Volozhin. It's a piece on Kabbalah. And in the introduction to the Sifra D'Tzinuta, it's a piece by the Vilna Gaon. Piece by the Vilna Gaon. In the introduction, the Vilna Gaon's primary Talmud, Rav Chaim Volozhin, writes an introduction. Here's the introduction of Rav Chaim. It's a very long introduction, but he writes the following thing. And that is that you should know that the Vilna Gaon, when he was struggling with Kabbalah and angels came to speak to him, he would speak to the angels and he would learn from the angels. But when the Vilna Gaon was struggling with halacha and the angels wanted to tell him what the halacha was, he would shoo the angels away. He would tell them, "I don't want to have anything to do with you." I mean, this is the Vilna Gaon of Rav Chaim. I mean, it's a stretch that they believe that there's angels. You know, but the idea is, you know, the famous story that the Rambam says there's no such thing as Shadim. So the Vilna Gaon writes that there used to be Shadim. But once the Rambam wrote there were no Shadim, all the Shadim disappeared. It's a famous Vilna Gaon. So the Vilna Gaon writes, the last paragraph, "For I heard many times from the Rav Chaim Volozhin writes, from the mouth of the Holy One, the Vilna Gaon, that many times Magidim from the heavens came down and were willing to share with him the secrets of Torah without any need for him to struggle. He did not give his ear, pay attention to them. One of the Magidim was very obstinate. With all this, he did not look at the angel's great visions. He, Vilna Gaon, answered the angel and said, 'I do not want that my knowledge of God's Torah be communicated by any type of medium, only what my eyes should be able to perceive, the wisdom of Torah according to what God wishes to reveal to me through my studies. God should give me a portion in his Torah through my toils, my struggles, which I pursue with all my strength. God should give me the wisdom from the mouth of Dat and Tevuna, and God should give me a heart that understands, and my kidneys should be like two foundations.'" In other words, "I don't want to know anything that the angels teach me. I only want to know what I can learn myself. I'm shooing away any angels that want to help me." Nevertheless, we will see in the next page of our handout that there seems to be times in which, clearly in the Gemara, divine intervention is embraced and is used. So how do we deal with this? Let's look at the sources that question everything that we just said. Source 23. Source 23 is a story where in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, there comes two people. One person says, "This is my slave. I bought him from Plony." And Plony says, "You didn't buy him from me. You stole him. You kidnapped him from me in the middle of the night. And he's really still my slave." Moshe Rabbeinu says, "We're going to decide whose slave this person is by where the portion of man for this slave falls. If it falls in front of Plony's tent, it means that the other person stole him. If it falls by the other person's tent, it means that Plony sold him." This seems to be the use of divine intervention to make a halachic decision. This is dine mamamos. And there's a halachic, we see that it's being used. And then there's a source number 24, which can be explained with the Rav Kook that we learned, that it seems that the prophets came back to the second temple to show the exact location of the Mizbeach. That's a halacha in Kachim. And we see that the prophets are being used here. One could say that they weren't being used as prophets, but just as individuals who were there during the first Beis HaMikdash. But look at sources 25 and 26. Let's say a person, he hasn't gone out many times with the person he's about to marry. He goes through Kiddushin with the person. He puts a ring on a sister. They're twins. He puts a ring on his sister. He says, "Hareyat mekudeshet li betabatzo kedat Moshe v'Yisrael." He goes away for a little while before the Nisuin. He forgets. He's not sure which one of the twins he married. He's not sure which one of the twins he married. The Gemara says that when Eliyahu comes, Eliyahu can decide which one he married. And therefore, she would be a bat chalitza or yibum in case the person passed away. So once again, here's a halacha in Ishus. And you see that we're allowing divine intervention to decide. The next story is a child of a Kohen's child gets mixed up with the Kohen's maidservant. One can work in the Beis HaMikdash, one cannot work in the Beis HaMikdash. So Tosfos says that when Eliyahu comes, he'll tell us which one is the Kohen's child and which one is the child of the Shifcha, the maidservant of the Kohen. So here we see minimally three cases. The case with the man, the case with the not sure which one you married, and the case with the, we're not sure which one is the child of the Kohen, and we see that Eliyahu can be involved in some form of reconciliation of what the halacha is. How does this answer all the literature that we've just discussed that seems to indicate that you can't do that? Yes?
It sounds like Teiku. He's not saying he's going to give Satan. When it all comes, we need time to Shia.
So,
well, the issue will be resolved.
So Dr. Kranzler, the only person that defines Teiku as Tishbi, Yataritz, Kushas, Bios is the Shla. Everyone else defines Teiku as we'll leave it in abeyance. They don't define it like that.
Either way, it means it's not a Pesach at this point.
But how can you say here it says Mamish that Eliyahu can answer the question? Yes? Good, good. So develop that idea.
And the other ones are
so the, okay. So the Mishnah Lamelech. Beautiful. I'm going to explain it in a second. Yes, please.
Basically, there's no halachic decision here. The simple question is, what is the reality? Right? If this is the Kohen's child, then we know that halachas apply. There's no halachas to be given to us. If this is the maidservant's child, we know which halachas apply to that. There's no halachas to be given to us. In the case of the guy who was Mekayesh the sister, if we know which sister, like if he suddenly gets anti-amnesia and he suddenly realizes who he did it with, and she suddenly realizes who he did it with, you know, there are ways of, it's not, there's no halacha here.
Beautiful. So the answer that was just being...
The word is im yavo.
All right. Fine. Im yavo. Okay. So, let's the answer is beautiful. That's the answer of the Mishnah Lamelech, source 27. And really, if you just permit me for a minute just to explain what he says, and then I want to conclude with a little bit more on this issue. And that is, there are two dimensions to the halachic process. One dimension of the halachic system allows for divine intervention in helping to solve its dilemmas, while the other one forbids its use to come to any legal conclusion. The category that permits it is divine intervention to determine a factual reality. When the halacha's concern is born out of the fact that the factual reality is uncertain, you don't know who the shifcha is supposed to be with, who this child is, you don't know who he married, which one he married, you don't know who owns this eved. Divine intervention is acceptable. Since the divine is an ultimate source of truth, any credible indication from this source of what is the true reality can be welcomed. Therefore, in all of the above cases from the Gemara and from the Tosfos, divine intervention is acceptable, since it's used merely to ascertain a factual reality, namely who owns the slave, which child is the Kohen, or, you know, which person did this individual marry. Where does divine intervention not work? When the relationship between halacha and the event or the reality is in question. In other words, every phenomenon in this world needs to be analyzed through the prism of halacha. This cannot be done through divine intervention, but needs a set of halachic protocols. So, for example, what does halacha say about who is the mother when the egg comes from one person and the host mother is a different person? That it's not a shaila in mitzias. It's not a shaila in a factual reality. It's a shaila in what defines maternity. Is there such a thing as posthumous paternity? That's not a halacha in a factual reality. That's a halacha in what is the relationship between a phenomenon and halacha. In those cases, divine intervention cannot be used. The only time divine intervention can be used is when the challenge is, as was just stated so beautifully, and it's stated by the Mishnah Lamelech, is when it's a machlokis in mitzias. There's a suffix in mitzias. And when there's a suffix in mitzias, then there is the permission to use divine intervention. Because divine intervention is truth. The only, however, when it comes to defining halacha, you are not allowed to allow any form of divine intervention because that's our responsibility. Remember that, indeed, that's not everyone follows that. Rav Yaakov of Merve, one of the late Balei Tosfos from the late 12th and 13th century, wrote 89 tshuvas, which he said he got from Shemayim. Rav Kook writes that divine intervention can be used in certain situations when you can't come to a conclusion through the necessary halachic process. But the normative approach in Judaism, the normative approach, 99% of the people say exactly what was just stated so beautifully here. And that is the only time that we allow divine intervention is when the shaila is in a factual reality. But when the shaila is in defining a phenomenon, it's our responsibility to continue the halakhic process. I remember when we got married, we had the privilege of Rabbi Soloveitchik being the Masada Kedushin. And it was unfortunately bittersweet because it was the final public event that Rabbi Soloveitchik was at. And it was at Marina Del Rey, very close to here, no steps, so he would have no problems walking. And the caterer actually hired his own photographer and his own videographer also because Rabbi Soloveitchik was doing it and he wanted it for his, for his wall, so to say. Not so to say. He wanted it for his wall. So what happens is we got two sets of photographers, two sets of videographers. I don't have to tell anybody here what that means. And Rabbi Soloveitchik is doing it, and he's very low voice. So the 300 people are basically just surrounding this chuppah. And at the end of the chuppah, it was a very interesting chuppah. At the end of the chuppah, Rabbi Soloveitchik couldn't stay for the meal. So we didn't get danced down. We spent two private minutes with Rabbi Soloveitchik, my wife and I. And I said, Rabbi, I want to thank you for coming. I hope we'll be able to share future smachot together when we have children, when we have a boy, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, shalom zachar, et cetera. He makes this comment, which I didn't have a clue what he said. He said, I look forward to sharing more simchas with you, but if you have any shalom zachar, don't serve chickpeas. Okay. I thought it was a joke. I thought it was like you guys. I thought it was a joke. That's it. Okay. Rabbi Soloveitchik was very ill. And as I said, it was the last public event he was at. A few years later, our firstborn son, Tuvia, is born. And I remember this thing Rabbi Soloveitchik says, don't serve chickpeas. I start going through the Taz in Yoredeya, Simon Reis Samachay, brings down the notion of having a Shalom Zachar, and he writes, the minig is to have chickpeas because the child, as the Gemara Nida says, the child learned all of Torah and now forgot all of Torah, so the chickpeas is the food of a mourner. If you look at the Bir Hagra, he brings down the minig of having a Shalom Zachar, but he does not bring down the minig of having chickpeas. So all of a sudden, I start to think that maybe Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was not known for his greatest sense of humor, was basically trying to communicate something here. And I think he was. I think that what Rabbi Soloveitchik was trying to communicate was the following. That we don't serve chickpeas at a Shalom Zachar for the following reason. Chickpeas represent the idea that the child has lost all of his Torah and he's now in a state of mourning. We're in a state of mourning that he's lost all of his Torah. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes in one of his articles that the Gemara Nida that tells us that every one of us, men, young, every baby, boy or girl, learns all of Torah and then forgets it. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that's the most beautiful statement in the world, because what is it telling us? That every Jew, when they study Torah, is not studying something new. It's not something new that we're studying. It's that we're victims of amnesia, and all that we're learning is our original identity. We're all victims of amnesia. And throughout our odyssey in life, we're just exploring and finding our original identity. Once again, that our original identity was lost to us, and now we're exploring it. It's not something to mourn about, it's something to celebrate. The fact that we are involved in the halachic process, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to say, has withdrawn from the halachic process so that we should be able to continue that halachic process, is the beauty of what it means to be a Jew, or the beauty of what it means to be a human being. The idea that we continue the creative process that God began. That the creative process did not end with Har Sinai, The creative process just began with Har Sinai. That when Moshe Rabbeinu sat in the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Akiva, he didn't understand the word that was going on. That's the most beautiful thing in the world. Moshe understood the Torah of his time. Rabbi Akiva understood the Torah of his time. Our job, our mission, is to understand the message of this beautiful opportunity that's given to us. This idea of Lo Bashamayim. That the halachic process has begun. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us rules and regulations, principles. We have to use those principles. But once he's given us those principles, it's our responsibility to take the halachic process to every contemporary situation and to celebrate the relationship between every contemporary situation and the halakha process. Meanwhile, my mother brought chickpeas to the Shul Shul. I had this major fight with her, which is not something to know about. But perhaps the Gemara, when it says that Eliyahu HaNavi sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Tanur Achnai says, okay, and sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu is smiling, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, what did the Jewish people do? Nitzchuni b'nai nitzchuni. It can mean what I said before. My children have won. But nitzchuni b'nai nitzchuni can mean something else also. It can mean, my children have immortalized me. My children have immortalized me. Because how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu become immortal? HaKadosh Baruch Hu becomes immortal when we are committed to continuing to celebrate his Torah. When we take his Torah and we look at modern society through the prism of Torah values, when we take his Torah and we have the courage to make sure that it interfaces with all aspects of life. And what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling Eliyahu is Nitzchuni b'nai nitzchuni. When we have the charisma and the courage to embrace every contemporary situation through the prism of Torah values, then we guarantee not only the eternality of the Jewish people, but the immortality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Thank you very much.